hundreds and hundreds of abandoned trucks, a virtual metal graveyard, just part of the 3.5 million items littering an empty Afghan base. But after the Americans abruptly pulled out, why should we still worry? And later, Chris Hansen. It is the name that online predators fear the most. If he is waiting for you inside, you can bet the cops are outside. But he recently found himself on the other side of the law. I'll ask him why tonight on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. Security, stability, dare I say peace. We all hope those are the big ticket items left in Afghanistan by the two-decade-long presence of U.S. and allied forces. But tonight, three nights after the U.S. essentially and very quietly wrapped up its Afghan campaign, all we can say for sure is we left a lot of stuff there. Vehicles topping the list, in fact. Thousands and thousands of vehicles, we're told. Armored vehicles, civilian vehicles, some with keys, many without. They were left at the sprawling Bagram Air Base. In years past, it was a city unto itself. U.S. forces pulled out of Bagram in the pre-dawn hours last Friday, more than 3 months ahead of the deadline that was set by President Biden. And joining me now to break down the pullout and the fallout are three very shrewd observers. Chris Fussell is a former Navy SEAL who served multiple Afghan tours. He's currently president of the McChrystal Group and author of One Mission, How Leaders Build a Team of Teams. I'm also joined on the phone by best-selling author and filmmaker about Afghanistan, Sebastian Younger. His newest book is called Freedom. And I'd also like to welcome retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel and Senior Intelligence Operations Officer Tony Schaefer. He wrote about his time in Afghanistan, undercover, in fact, in the book Operation Dark Heart. Welcome all. Lieutenant Colonel Schaefer, I'd like to begin with you. Your reaction to hearing the news that it was a quick pullout and that so much was left behind.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic, Ashley. Thank you for having me. Members of Congress asked Tony Zinni, General Zinni, to go back and do an assessment of what it would take to pull out of Afghanistan back in 2010. And General Zinni was part of the team that went in and assessed and said it would take us literally years to pull everything out. So it's not entirely surprising that you've seen kind of the withdrawal and leaving literally billions of dollars of stuff. At one point, Tony found on a remote base, much like the Restrepo base, a Connex with a bus in it, and you couldn't even drive on the roads there. So we came and put a lot of stuff, often ineffectively, into Afghanistan. And it's a bit tragic that you now see all of this gear left behind and not properly passed over to the security forces, which we hope would continue to serve the Afghan people and the Afghan government. It's a bit of a tragedy.
So since you just mentioned Restrepo, that's a good place for Sebastian Younger to jump in, because your film was called Restrepo. You spent months and months in country, and I'm sure Bagram was at least a stop a few times. Your thoughts seeing these sort of ghost town-like images?
Yeah, well, let me say, there were a lot of outposts like Restrepo that were very, very small. I mean, they were the size of a bus. There's no way they could have had a bus in them. They were literally the size of a bus. And, you know, manned by very, very brave troops that sometimes fought, you know, virtually every day to hold that position. It was a world away, universe away from a place like Bagram. I was in Bagram in the fall of 2000, about a year before 9/11, and Bagram was filled with, I was with the Northern Alliance, with Ahmad Shah Massoud, and Bagram was filled with Soviet hardware, fighter planes and trucks and everything else, and a lot of landmines. And, you know, now, 20 years on, you know, it's filled with American stuff. I think, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of that could have been put to better use, but I'm not surprised that it wound up this way. I think when empires pull out of places like Afghanistan, you know, it's like very slowly, and then it's overnight. You know, it's like very, very quick when it comes down to it.
Well, I remember seeing those Soviet MiGs on those tarmacs, and they were littered with mines. It was a very dangerous place that became a virtual city. Chris Fussell, there were reports that the Americans just picked up under cover of darkness and left without telling anyone, you know, in the Afghan army. But that just sounded curious to me. It's not usually how things work. And sure enough, a lot of the generals who've weighed in today said, don't always believe everything you hear from some of the Afghan leadership. How do you weigh in?
Yeah, I think there's no easy way to leave a conflict zone after 20 years, as Sebastian pointed out. We have great leadership on the ground in General Scott Mellon and others. They have a security issue on their hands for their own people. And so you have to do these things with that top of mind. So you can't broadcast your exact withdrawal plan. I'm sure there were coordinating meetings behind the scenes with our Afghan partners, who we've developed deep and strong relationships with over two decades. And so these things may look sudden and jerky towards the end, but there's a broader security picture that has to be taken into account when senior leadership on the ground is trying to unwind 20 years worth of buildup.
Lieutenant Colonel Schaefer, 20 years of buildup. You'd think that the Afghan army would have learned a lot of the lessons by now. You'd think that all that training, two decades worth of training, would be sufficient to hold the country, to fend off the Taliban. And I keep hearing upwards of 50% of the country's been taken back. How does that happen?
I think it's a fundamental flaw in our thinking that created this. I've argued that we should have followed the methodology of how we won the fight in 2001, 2002 by working with the Afghan militia forces. The militias are coming back strong. I think they were the best bet. We're actually having success with something called the Village Support Operations Program back in about 2010, 2011, where we were divesting ourselves of the central government, because we were seeing back then that the Afghan National Army was not going to be a national army. It continued to have high desertion rates. It never had the cohesion of the Iraqi military even. And now in the end, and yes, I understand that we've had a large investment of leader-on-leader training. I've talked to a number of colonels. I worked with General Dunford when he was commander there. But the bottom line is, unless you have a concerted culture that recognizes the needs of a national service, you're going to see the chaos ensue when there's no leadership, our leadership, there to hold it together. So I think we should have recognized how we succeeded to begin with and really attempted to emulate that as we removed ourselves. And at this point, I don't believe the Afghan National Army will survive much past October, November of this year at the current rate of what I'm seeing it fall apart at.
Well, that's just really depressing, considering the trillions of dollars,
yes, ma'am,
the thousands of American lives that we spent there. You know, that's a good question for Sebastian to weigh in on. You lived with the men and women who fought, who were committed to the mission. And to hear that assessment, Sebastian, I mean, I think it's got to be upsetting to you and upsetting to a lot of the troops you worked with.
You know, the guys that I was with, they were very focused on their deployment. I mean, honestly, they didn't think in, generally, they didn't think in sort of the largest frame. So they have a lot of strong feelings and mixed feelings and conflicting feelings about their service in Afghanistan and what we were doing there and everything else. But I think everyone knew eventually America was going to pull out and that it may leave behind a bit of a mess. We did. I mean, everyone acknowledged, everyone that I know acknowledges that our presence there did allow us to kill and capture almost all of Al-Qaeda, which, of course, was the initial impulse in 2001. The nation building that went along with that effort was an attempt to stabilize the country so that Al-Qaeda and other groups like that could not take root in the sort of failed state that Afghanistan was in the 1990s. I'll finish by just saying this. I was there in 1996 when the Taliban were taking over, and I remember being told by a Pashtun in Kabul, we'd just been shot at by a Taliban gunner on the outskirts of Kabul, and he said, you know, we hate those guys, but we're going to let them in because the Afghan government is completely corrupt. And the Taliban, as awful as they are, they will stop the corruption. And that's what this country needs. And so I think our strategic error, the United States' strategic error, we had a huge amount of goodwill among the Afghans after 9/11. I mean, I saw it. I experienced it, as I'm sure you did as well. Our huge mistake was leaving 15,000 troops there and going on to Iraq and trying to fill in the gap in our manpower with tens, hundreds of billions of dollars, which really, it was like corruption on steroids in that country when we came in with all of our money. And I think that was what Afghans looked at and shook their heads and thought, this is not what we were hoping for.
Boy, I'll say, you know, Americans will clutch their pearls when I say this, but people used to say about the Taliban that thank God they stopped all the killing. Things did not get good for women, certainly, and things did not get good for Americans who, you know, when the Taliban let bin Laden in there to ply his trade. But let me ask you this, Chris Fussell, the kill and capture that we're talking about of so many of the bad guys, the Al-Qaeda folk and those who would do harm to the Afghan mission and the American mission in Afghanistan, many of them were actually imprisoned at Bagram. Last I heard, there were around 5,000 prisoners that the Americans would have left behind in the prison at Bagram. So the way I remember things working there is if you believe what I believe, you're okay. And if you don't believe what I believe, summary justice or truncated justice or, you know, execution on the spot. I'm pretty concerned about those 5,000 people.
It's a, not to overly simplify it, but you can compare it to the drawdown of materials on the ground. Again, the leadership there has this real conundrum. How much of a security bubble do we want to put around our folks that we have to withdraw? And the more prisoners I release or put into the justice system, I'm forecasting potential withdrawal dates because that sends a signal around your actions. And so, again, I'm sure this is a very, very calculated risk on the part of our leadership on the ground as to what we're going to do with these 5,000 prisoners. And you spent time on the ground, Ashley, as we all have. You know, in that 5,000, there's a broad range of folks that might be in for a day for some questioning, all the way up to a small, very smaller percentage of hardened fighters in most sort of spreads, which you'll find in a detention facility. And so, again, a calculated risk, not a perfect solution, but again, we have to empathize with our leaders on the ground that are really choosing between a series of bad alternatives when you try to do something this complex in a shortened timeline.
Yeah, I'm worried about the ones that are innocent. I'm worried about the ones that are guilty because some will go free because they're friendly with the incoming folk. And some will just, like I said, suffer terribly at their hands because they don't have the right ideology. Guys, if you can hold on for a second, there are a few questions I want to continue on after the break, not the least of which is all the gear that we left behind, just rows upon rows of perfectly good trucks, and that's the least of it. Medical equipment, entire hospitals, just so much treasure we left behind. And then there are the weapons and the ammo. Could that be used on us? Because once upon a time, it was. Those questions next. Welcome back. Our focus is the pullout of United States forces from Afghanistan after 20 years and everything that they have left behind. And I'm not just talking about the hard goods. My guests are retired Navy SEAL Chris Fussell and retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, both Afghan war veterans, and the acclaimed journalist, author, and filmmaker Sebastian Younger, who joins us by phone. Also, a lot of time Sebastian spent in country. So, Tony Schaefer, let me ask you a little bit about the gear. I think Americans look at it and think, what a colossal waste. I mean, there are images of hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of perfectly good vehicles that, I don't know, look like they would fit on a C-130 that you could bring home. And then there are hospitals left behind. And it seems like this, all of this infrastructure that we spent so much money on, that they just didn't choose to bring home. Why is that?
Well, it's expensive for one, and we have limited routes out. Much of the gear that you see now at Bagram came through Pakistan, and that road from through the countryside back out is very difficult. Actually, we've been taking gear out since Tony's in his survey back in 2010, And from that point on, there was an attempt to start pulling out major pieces of military equipment. I think a lot of the gear you see is left primarily, theoretically, can be used by the Afghan forces for purposes of their own use to defend Afghanistan. Plus, much of that gear probably was used as part of our training program. We spent a lot of blood and treasure training the Afghan military to be an effective force. And so many of those things you see were left behind, probably, again, very likely for the purposes of trying to transition over to the Afghan forces. Plus, there's the Air Force that we've helped build of theirs. And there's all the outposts. Again, as Sebastian said, we have dozens of outposts, which at this point, I know for a fact, were abandoned long before this year, that were full of gear as well. So it's we had a huge investment of resources, which literally whoever takes over next, if it's the Afghan government who can sustain themselves, or the Taliban coming back in, or the warlords, they're going to be very well equipped, whoever they are.
Well, let's hope that the corruption doesn't take over and they don't get in all the wrong hands, which leads me, Chris Fussell, to this next question. When I was in country in 2001, all I ever saw were groups of men riding around in Toyotas in the back of the flatbed with a bunch of RPGs. And lo and behold, they were our RPGs. They were, you know, they were things that we left behind back in the 80s and 90s, and they were pointed now at us as Americans. So I wonder if we learned a lesson and maybe didn't leave behind so much ordnance for them to use on, oh, I don't know, maybe us again one day.
Yeah, it's, unfortunately, some of it's unavoidable, both from heavy equipment to small arms, ammunition, et cetera. We all remember images of the withdrawal from Vietnam with helicopters being pushed over the edge of an aircraft carrier because they were just, to Tony's point, too expensive and the logistics too complex to get back to the States. On the small arms side, again, I would agree, similar to the vehicle position with our Afghan allies, some will be left behind in hopes of arming them. Some of that will end up in the wrong hands. That's absolutely unavoidable. And you know as well as we do from your time on the ground, a lot of the small arms we were facing there were Soviet munitions that had been left behind when they withdrew. So this is cyclical in war, and the best thing leaders on the ground can hope to do is mitigate it to the greatest extent possible, support our allies that are being left on the ground with arms and equipment, and stay engaged so that a minimal amount ends up in the wrong hands, but a small percentage is absolutely inevitable. Every withdrawal from a combat zone will prove that point.
Well, then we're going to rely on a lot of honor. And to that point, Sebastian Younger, I know you're going to know the answer to this because you spent time with the people on the ground. Donald Trump made a deal with the Taliban back in 2020, saying, we'll pull our troops out if you promise never to allow bad guys to stage in your country and, you know, target us and attack us. And the Taliban said, sure. How much do you think they're going to honor that deal?
You know, the Taliban are obviously brilliant strategic thinkers. And I say obviously because they fought the greatest military power ever in history, and not that they won, but they didn't lose for 20 years until we got tired and pulled out. They don't want to go through that again either, right? I mean, they were soundly defeated in 2001. We didn't follow up very well with our victory, but they were, you know, fighting a war from the caves of, you know, the mountains and the forests and the canyons of Afghanistan for 20 years at huge cost to themselves. I'm guessing that they're not anxious to repeat that cycle either. They want to control Afghanistan and make it an Islamic republic, and I think it's within their capability to do that. And it's possible that they won't jeopardize that project by allowing in rich Saudis who want to bankroll terrorists. Like, I don't quite see what their advantage is there.
So, Tony Schaefer, this is going to sound like a dumb question, but I think it's a really important question, because every time America wraps up a war, it seems like there's some finality to it, right? Either an armistice or a treaty or something. But I feel like there's nothing. I just don't know if we won or lost, but I feel more like the latter. Is that wrong?
We won, but we chose to, as Sebastian said, to not complete the victory in a way that was effective. Look, there's a number of forces on the ground there now that'll play out. The Chinese have copper mines. They have an investment in Afghanistan. The Pakistanis have fought a long war to bring stability to the tribal areas. And I have been a big critic of the PACs, but the Pakistanis have done an amazing job of trying to bring stability to the region where, by the way, the Taliban had safe havens and could launch with impunity attacks back into Afghanistan. So I believe the Pakistanis also have an interest in now bringing some level of stability to Afghanistan. So I agree with Sebastian. I don't think the Afghans, the Taliban, or any of the tribes want to see full-blown conflict. Does that mean it's going to be peaceful? Does that mean our investment there was for naught? No, I think we completed the terms of the authorized use of military force. Once bin Laden was assassinated through Neptune Spear back in 2011, our mission there was ended. We should have, I think, gone for the door faster and tried to decide on how to empower the tribes and our allies more quickly. But we are where we are. We don't have a complete victory, but we didn't lose either.
Well, I'm only going to ask this last question of Chris Fussell, and I need to do it, in about a minute if possible. But I know you have said that the geographic criticality of Afghanistan doesn't go away. It's still a really important piece of dirt, for all global influence, right? So the question I have is, who's going to be the next guy? And is the next guy who comes in there to try to, stabilize and at least position for whatever global influence the next guy needs, are we safe from them?
In 60 seconds or less, I would say probably the biggest hegemon in the region that already has plans in place would be the Chinese as part of the Belt and Road Initiative. And they've been thinking about that for a while. With us removed from relationships directly on the ground with the Afghan government and the Taliban, to Sebastian's point, they're pragmatic, if nothing else. They're probably going to find a way to leverage that opportunity. And without being on the ground, you lose influence. You save lives, you save money, but you lose influence with the governments on the ground. So you're going to have to find another way to interact with that near-peer competitor in the Chinese.
Well, that was perfect. I wish our mission there had been the same as perfect. Chris Fussell and Tony Schaefer and Sebastian Younger, thank you. I knew I had the A-team on this panel. I appreciate all your wisdom. And thank you also for all the work you've all done. Coming up, straight ahead, the former host of To Catch a Predator, Chris Hansen, is going to join me to discuss the reason that he himself was arrested on Friday. You do not want to miss this.